Well, let's go out into space next with Dr. Peter Ward. We'll do that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Peter Ward with us. Peter, let's go out into space if we can for a moment and talk about what is out there and what are the possibilities. You're an astrobiologist, so that tells us what?
Well, it's funny that astrobiology is the study of life in the universe, but we have, as you know, only one known example. But I was lucky enough, just a month ago, actually, I was flown to Zurich, Switzerland, to have a debate with Dr. Jonathan Lunin. He was the principal investigator of the beautiful satellite mission that went to Titan, the moon of Saturn. So he was head of the Cassini mission, and Jonathan and I were supposed to debate the frequency of complex life. And they, because I wrote this book, Rare Earth, suggested that maybe human-like aliens aren't quite as common as the movies would have us. In fact, Jonathan totally agreed with me, and we pulled a fast one on the organizers. Instead of slugging it out, both of us suggest that we should go to Titan. If you want to see alien life in the solar system, there would be no more alien life than on Titan, and we both think it has the best chance for supporting life, even better than Mars, and certainly better than Europa or a Jupiter moon.
Do you think that something could exist in those methane oceans out there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the problem with our kind of life is that we freeze. The cold temperatures, Carl Sagan years ago said, look, if you put a little bit of antifreeze into an Earth organism, and by antifreeze, he said, just make it a little bit of ammonia. Water is a solvent. For chemistry to work, to make life run, you need a solvent to be able to break up specific molecules. We know ammonia is a solvent. Ammonia freezes at way lower temperatures. So both Jonathan and I think that you could very well have ammonia life in both the Jupiter's moons, but especially Titan with all those organic compounds.
Peter, there is a tree wood frog that literally freezes in the winter. Its heart stops. Ice grows right over its body, and it stays dead frozen until it thaws out in the spring, and then it comes back to life again. And it has the ability to put this antifreeze in its cellular system so it doesn't freeze to death. It's an amazing story.
Yep. It's a good story, and it's highly relevant. And the thing is, though, that even we're talking about temperatures that are minus 20, minus 40 on Earth. When you're heading out into space, it's way colder, so not even that system is going to work. But look, that example is perfect. It shows us how adaptable life is. What was that great line by Dr. Malcolm in Jurassic Park? Life will find a way. Well, there's truth to that. Life will find a way. And I'm pretty convinced that we're going to find a variety of at least microbial life on Mars, on Titan, and certainly in the oceans of Europa.
I got to believe that you believe that there might be intelligent life out there somewhere. What do you think?
Absolutely. Look, the numbers are so huge. There's 300 billion stars. We know from the new missions, the Kepler mission, how common planets are. If there are 5 to 10 planets per star, 300 billion, once you start doing the math, I think it's so astronomically improbable that we are the unique intelligence in the cosmos as to be ridiculous. There have to be thousands of species. But what we don't understand, I think, and fully understand is how big that universe is. There could be thousands of species, each so separated that even flying radio waves or any sort of communication, the islands are too far apart. You always think you're alone, even though you're not. It's very difficult to send signals over the vast distances.
The old thought of panspermia, that we somehow started from a comet or something from outside of our own solar system that came in. Do you subscribe to that?
Yeah, that's a great old theory. Fred Hoyle, and it's just, George, by the way, my admiration for you is amazing. You have certainly know your stuff. Panspermia has been looked at a couple of ways recently. One of my really best friends who is at Caltech, and you should get him on the show, Dr. Joe Kirschfink of Caltech, he was the guy, he really still believes the Martian meteorite did have life. he studies magnetite. And as you know, those tiny little grains look very much like bacterial magnetite. But Joe also studied the magnetics of the Martian meteorite, and he showed quite clearly that the rock itself was never heated to the point that it would have killed life. Joe is sure that panspermia works. Joe is also absolutely certain that we are Martians, and he has some very good cogent ideas that life had to start on Mars and not Earth. And I can 30 seconds, I could give you a pretty convincing
answer.
Yeah,
no, go ahead. Go ahead. I'd love to hear this.
So the thing about our kind of life is we have DNA, but before there was DNA, there's something called RNA, and the R in RNA is called ribose. It's a sugar. If you ever baked a cake and screwed up by leaving it in too long, sugar, when it's heated too long, turns into a black, tarry, awful stuff.
Yep.
It goes from something you really want to eat to a horrendous business. And there's this idea that life on Earth started in hydrothermal vents, but the critics said the temperatures are too high. Well, there's a brilliant chemist in Florida, University of Florida, named Steve Benner. Steve was part of my astrobiology team, and he's really an amazing guy, but he has figured out that ribose, the sugar, can be made naturally in deserts. When I was a boy, Ronald Reagan was pitching borax soap in Death Valley days, brought to you by 20 Mule Team Borax. I bet some of your listeners remember those days.
Oh, yeah. Even me.
There we go. The soap itself has a sugar in it that is just like ribose. These guys, Kirschfink and Benner, combined to make the suggestion that, yes, indeed, you can get ribose, but only on a planet that's a desert planet. The Earth, the first billion years, was virtually completely covered by oceans. No land. How are you going to have an ocean planet producing a desert? Mars. We know Mars had half ocean, half land, big deserts. Life probably could have started, and the meteors brought it here. Kirschfink and I are just about to come out with a book. It'll be out in about 6 months. It's called A New History of Life. And in it, we propose that we are Martians, and we give the scientific evidence, and we think it's pretty convincing.
If we are Martians and we developed, is it possible that Mars might have had, you know, creatures like us roaming the planet before something catastrophic happened to it?
Is it possible? Absolutely. Is it probable? That's harder. We know Mars could have had an oxygen atmosphere for its first half billion years. We know it had oceans. It could have had plants. What we don't know is, and unfortunately, Mars is just too small to keep an atmosphere. It's just not large enough. It doesn't have a good magnetic field, and so it's bombarded by all kinds of radiation. Look, the other thing we know, George, is if astronauts go to Mars, if they spend 6 months on the planet, their probability of getting cancer and dying later in their life is high.
Really?
The radiation load on Mars is, oh boy.
Huge.
And the other thing, 2000, yeah, it's bad. So, yes, there could have been sentient beings on Mars, and it would have been a fast evolution. But look, we went from jellyfish to humans in a half billion years. Mars had a half billion years of ocean early on. Why couldn't the same thing have happened?
How soon in the Mars' ball game did it lose everything it had?
Quickly. Everything, just where we are after 4.5 billion years, Mars did in less than a billion. It's just too small. It doesn't have enough mass to hold on to the atmosphere it gets. And so you just have this very thin atmosphere. It's a question of mass.
So that's basically what happened. It might have had all these oceans, plant life, in atmosphere, clouds, but it dissipated fast.
Absolutely. And this is why I keep telling NASA, as if they listen to me, the first person who needs to step onto the Martian surface should be a paleontologist.
Yeah.
You need to get a drill. You go take cores. I suspect you're going to find microbial fossils, but more than that, something larger. But it's going to have to be fossils. I don't think anything could be still living there. Or if it is, it's going to be deep in the rocks.
We've had guests on, Peter, who have shown us pictures, and they are strange, of things that could look like seafood fossils that are embedded in, you know, Martian rock. by different photographs. It's very weird, weird stuff.
Well, again, I'm a believer. I just still think that we're going to find a fossil record. And one of the books that I propose, actually a TV series, I wanted to do a paleontology of the solar system. Think about what past life may have been on Europa. Think about the fossils that you might find on Titan. We certainly have a fossil record on Earth, Mars. And what about Venus? Venus was our twin early on before it got too hot. But this thought that we are unique in the universe is just it's nonsense.
This this pace that ended up creating us, do you think that the formula is so perfect that it would happen on every other planet that had our same kind of complexity?
There's a branch of biology and that studies evolution, and the type of evolution you're talking about is called convergent evolution. But if you get the same particular properties, you'll probably get the same life form over and over. And this is why we had fish, and then we had marine reptiles called ichthyosaurs, which looked just like fish and just like dolphins later. Because physics dictates body form. Physics really dictates lots of things about chemistry. You're probably going to get, if you have the same atmospheric chemistry, the same pressures, the same ocean, you're going to get the same looking creatures.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. And probably over the same time period, too, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's just evolution takes place at the pace that is dictated by the natural conditions and the change of conditions. All planets change. All planets are constantly changing. And catastrophes affect all planets all the time. That's the mix that causes evolution to keep reshuffling and moving forward.
What created the jumpstart where we are today? I'm taking religion out of the equation here. I'll take out, you know, belief in God for a moment. What do you think the jumpstart was? I mean, for me, Peter, it's kind of hard to believe that a little tiny organism, a single cell, ended up being what we are today.
Well, the biggest jumpstart of all was when we started getting oxygen in the atmosphere. We had probably a billion years of single-celled life. There was not much to it. It was a sulfur chemistry. It ate hydrogen like a hydrogen car for fuel. Very simple stuff. But then there came along, and this was probably the biggest jump, the ability for photosynthesis. Using some minerals that were available, one of these tiny little sulfur organisms invented a way to split water, hydrolysis of water. And once you split water, you've got an oxygen molecule that's broken out. So very slowly, oxygen started rising in the atmosphere until about 2.5 billion years ago, and there was a huge rush of it. Some very, very good biologists have shown that only oxygen atmospheres are there that can allow the physiology of active movement. I mean, you can have life, but it can't move much. If you want animal life, and we animals, what are we characterized by? Movement.
Right.
Our rapid movement, our muscles, you need oxygen to burn that fire. The chemical reactions that allow us to move fast, you can't have that without oxygen. So 2.5 billion years ago is when something really kick-started the biosphere.
And it just kept going.
It did.
Some people, for example, when they go to Denver, have trouble breathing because of the altitude. Would that be the same way on some planets that might not have the same oxygen makeup as we have?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the really interesting things about looking at the history of life, there's a fascinating moment at about 400 to 300 million years ago, and that's when the first forests began to spread. And once those forests began spreading, there was more and more oxygen in the atmosphere. But we start asking the question, the first fish that crawled out, the first amphibians that had this fish to amphibian transition, their lungs would have been terrible. I mean, you're not talking about a fully formed, efficient lung. You're talking about a fish that's gulping, trying to get air. Unless you had a high oxygen atmosphere already, you're never going to have land life, vertebrate land life like us. We had a series of geological accidents that caused oxygen to go way up about 350 million years ago. And that's when we were able to crawl out. And look, if we didn't have this oxygen rise, we might still be in the oceans. We may never have gotten out on the land.
Is it fair to you to toss the God factor now into this, and that all of a sudden we were created?
I'm a scientist. I have religion, but it's completely separated. So I don't think you need to invoke that. I think we have, from the fossil record and from what biology and geology have done, we have pretty good ideas that you don't need supernatural, that things, in fact, can move forward just from what we've discovered. I mean, there's an awful lot of really clever scientists out there. They've had a long time to work with this stuff. And even 50 years ago, it seemed incredible that we could have had the evolutionary panoply that we did. But we have seen now from various discoveries that it is possible.
Sadly, Peter, what needs to happen to wipe out mankind totally? What events?
Well, one good, big, Hale-Bopp-sized comet coming through would have. You remember beautiful Hale-Bopp at the end of the 20th century. And had that hit the Earth, there would not only be not complex life, there would be no microbes either. I think it was 50 kilometers in diameter. That would have been enough to snuff out all life. And I'll tell you, there's lots of Hale-Bopps out there.
Is there really anything we can do if it's coming this way?
Something that big? Nothing. You could, since it would be Earth-specific, you could put out large spaceships with trying to have factories and trying to have enough of a colony, maybe try to get something on the moon, maybe to Mars. But you know the sad story of Biosphere 2. What a joke. I mean, that was an enormous facility on the Earth, and yet within a couple of years, those people were going to die. They had everything going for them in the Arizona desert, and still the ecosystems broke down. It's a really sad example how big a colony ship you'd have to have, and that's the only way out. There's no moving the Earth. If we're going to get nailed with one of those big comets, you don't have much in the way of choices.
No, we don't have many choices at all, and that's the sad part. Would governments tell us, because they'd have some head start on something like that, would they tell us or would they not?
Well, a great question. I mean, the nice thing is that something as big as Hale-Bopp, you would see it coming from a long time away and a long way away. So you would have time. I still, one of my favorite stories of all time, When Worlds Collide, that beautiful novel of the 1930s. And they had, remember, Bronson Beta and Bronson Alpha, and they came in. George Powell made a wonderful movie about it. You had time. You had a year to set things up and get off the planet. About the government, who knows? I moved to Australia just to try out a different type of democracy after living my entire life in the U.S., and I'm seeing how a different democracy plays out. It's a different variety of the same species. At least it's democracy.
Well, Peter, let's hope that that day never comes, huh?
So I personally am an optimist. And again, I think that we're going to be able to move through these environmental crises, but the next 100 years are certainly the most critical in the history of our species.
What would be more of a possibility? A mankind disaster like a nuclear war or getting hit by some kind of comet?
I think the mankind disaster, because the comets, again, we know the frequency of big hits. We're going to have smaller hits. The scary scenario is that you could have the mankind disaster caused by the asteroid disaster. All we need to do is have another one of those world without summer. You know, the big Krakatoa volcano.
Yep.
I'm sure people have talked about this. Well, you had a couple of years without agriculture in the 1800s. Imagine now in the 2000s that we have a year or two.
Couldn't handle.
Where even we couldn't. A small asteroid hits, the dust goes up, photosynthesis stops. Say we had 5 years of no crops, then you're going to have short-term nuclear disasters, people throwing missiles trying to get what they can get.
Let's talk more about that possibility, Peter, when we come back. Then in our last hour with you, we'll take phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, next hour we'll take your phone calls with Dr. Peter Ward as we talk about things going on this planet and in space. Fascinating. Now, will someone launch in order to take over land, let's say, for food? Let's find out when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Dr. Peter Ward with us. Peter, now let's talk about this potential nuclear conflict here. What would spark it, first of all?
Probably food and territory. Sea level rise is coming, as we know, and much of the world's rice is grown at very, very low altitude, right at sea level. So if you start taking out rice fields in the most populous countries on the planet, the places I worry most about are deltas. The Nile Delta, we have in Vietnam big deltas, the Mekong in India. These things are very fragile, but yet the soil is the best in the whole world, of course. And that's where much of our agriculture feeding many of the Asian countries comes from. And yet that's what's going to be gone from sea level rise. India and Pakistan already hate each other. They're both nuclear armed, and yet they both are going to run smack into China. And all three of them are going to be fighting for water coming out of the Himalayas. As we reduce, unfortunately, the South China coast is the single most dangerous place for sea level rise. Dangerous in the sense that, well, the highest level of rise. Again, that's just sheer accident. But there will be sea level rise there faster than anywhere else. The Chinese are going to be losing lots of land area. So those three, I think those three could draw in through alliances with lots of other countries. But that's where the flashpoint will be, I believe.
There's an area in the Pacific Marshall Islands where the president is telling people we're fighting for survival, that the area could become uninhabitable. That may be one of the first places to tell the world, Peter, of what's to come.
Well, absolutely. And happily for at least some of the Pacific Island areas, New Zealand is starting to take in refugees from various low-lying island countries, but also we also have the areas where the U.S. dropped all its hydrogen bombs in the 50s, and many of these remain terribly radioactive. So you've got that double whammy, as well as the French, of course, blowing up lots of their bombs in Tahiti. But this rising sea level, it's not just those islands. Venice, you know, I wouldn't want to be buying real estate in Venice right now, and any of these low-lying coastal areas, or South Florida is very much in danger and in trouble.
It's not going to take much to take Venice down, is it?
No, it's not. But even more hazardous, the things we don't think about. I did an aerial map of Miami-Dade County when I was writing my last book, and I was very surprised to see that the toxic waste repositories, where untold gallons of household cleaner and oil change, all that stuff, many are right at sea level, the first things that get flooded, are these toxic waste areas.
Yes.
And so it's a very scary scenario.
They get carried right in and everything else. No, you're absolutely right on that. I've seen that happen back in the St. Louis area. 1993, they had the flood when the Mississippi went over its banks, and there were some areas there that were that just deluged, and those things would happen. The water would hit these areas where they had chemicals and things like that, and what a disaster, Peter.
Oh, it was. And unfortunately, that's the once in future scenarios that we're seeing. And so these are the things you don't think about. Already, look, in areas where you have grain ships and ships that are offloading, many of the docks were built thinking that the ocean is always going to be at the level that it is. When you start asking how much money does infrastructure change, if you have to raise a dock by 5 feet, well, one dock isn't that much. But I think even USA Today was estimating hundreds of billions to trillions of dollars in the next 50 years of just doing the infrastructure for even a 4 or 5 foot sea level change. It costs the world economy so much that you can't spend it on other things.
Peter, as we look at all these incredible earth changes that are out there, back in Australia where you are now, what is their biggest concern?
Well, one of it is that their northern coastline, once again, is that the northern coastline, just as the southern coast of the U.S., has had many people trying to get to a better life. Well, the better life here is so much better than what a lot of the Indonesians are having. I have a friend who works in a game area, one of the only places where one of the big oceanic turtles breeds. And this turtle evolved, stupidly enough, to lay its egg on one island. Well, the turtle eggs are a great source of food. And so Indonesians are coming in at night in boats, and they're fishing. They're fishing the Australian coastlines. So I mean, at this stage of the game, the other thing that Australia is doing is that it is digging up its mineral resources as fast as possible and selling them to China. Much of China's industrial boom is built upon Australian coal and Australian minerals.
Is there concern that China would try to take over Australia?
I'm certainly not going to say that on the air, but...
Go ahead, Peter, say it.
I don't think so, but let's just say that the Australian government has just bought a large number of U.S., I guess they're the new Raptor planes that we have,
yep.
Very high-tech planes.
One of the best.
And it certainly looks like it, but why would you do that if you weren't worried? And who would they be worried about? Who else would you have to have such a high-tech plane to defend against?
Good point. Terrorism, maybe? Nah.
I don't think so. So, look, as you saw, the Spratly Islands, these poor Filipinos were sitting fishing, and the Chinese a month ago came and shut them down. They made sure that the Filipinos couldn't get food because the Chinese are bound and determined to own the South China Sea, every bit of it.
Give us your timetable. Give us your clock on these sea levels. Are we talking about 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now, 10 years from now?
No, I think what we're seeing is we had one of the major changes. We referred to it earlier in the program, is that the Western Antarctic ice sheet is now known to be disintegrating. That disintegration is going to add at least 10 feet of sea level change to the already increasing sea level just from the glaciers going away. So we know that mountain glaciers are all retreating. As they do, all that water as they melt causes the ocean to go up. What we were hoping wouldn't happen very fast were these big ice sheets in Greenland and on Antarctica to start melting faster, but they are melting faster. So our question becomes, is it how long? And that's the one that we can't crystal ball. In your and my lifetime, I don't think we're going to see a catastrophic change except for the storms. We'll see that. But in our children's lifetime, yes, I think by 50 years from now, there will be such significant sea level, maybe as much as 4 feet, hopefully no more than 4 feet, that it affects agriculture and geopolitics and becomes the single driving aspect of geopolitics.
Well, and in somewhat of a case, you put an ice cube in a glass of water, it melts, that level goes up. I guess we're talking about the same thing, huh? Same principle?
So, absolutely. So the thing, people think about the Arctic where there's already ice floating on it, that has no effect. You can melt all the Arctic ice, that pack ice, that's just the sea level of the ocean, the top of the ocean freezing. It's the ice on land. Every molecule of water that melts from ice on land is going to raise the ocean by one molecule higher. This is the scary thing. It's the ice on land that's melting that is really, really affecting us.
When you've been doing this for so many years, are you immune to some of these things that you know, or are you concerned too?
Well, I'm concerned, and I have two children, and my greatest concern is for those two children. But at the same time, I've been working in the Philippines, and I see all these fishermen who have four or five or six children each, and I'm out there trying to tell the U.S. government that we should shut down some of the trade of some of the really endangered species that are being taken out of the tropical oceans. But I'm telling these fathers and these mothers that they're not allowed to feed their kids. I mean, it is just so tragic that we have too many people on this planet.
I saw a report that the oceans could be dead in terms of lack of fish in like 10 or 20 years. That's unbelievable.
Well, not really. Again, I've made 300 hours of film of the Philippine deepwater ocean area. And this is off the Great Barrier Reef. We use it as comparison because there's no fishing allowed in most of the areas we look at off the Great Barrier Reef of Australia. So this is a big, long-term, decadal preserve. Lots of deepwater fish. There are no rules in the Philippines, and there's no fish. So you just multiply that by what's going on in Asia. We worked in Fiji and Samoa, and what I was very astonished by years ago, I used to work in Fiji, and most of the fishermen, the foreign fishermen, were Japanese. But, I mean, this may sound like a broken record, but the Fijians have sold their entire fishing consortium to the Chinese. We've got Chinese fishing boats everywhere in Fiji, and we have Fijian officials driving beautiful Mercedes.
A changing planet, Peter Ward, truly is. What would you do if, you know, you were speaking before heads of government right now? What would you tell them to do?
I would tell them to get the best science advisors that they can find and listen to them. And I would tell them that be ready to get unelected pretty quickly, but show some backbone.
So it's going to be one of those things where they have to make some very unpopular decisions?
Yeah, but it's going to have to be decisions that are unpopular, but they're also wise. And they're all, none of them are palatable in a way, but they're difficult, but they're tractable. I think there is hope. I think we really, the brains of our species, so unbelievable. We'll figure it out. But it's not to say it's going to be easy or that we're going to be happy doing it.
They're talking in Los Angeles, in Las Vegas, of some very serious water shortages, drinking water shortages. Now, that's another big problem. Why can't we desalinate? Why can't we do what some countries are doing?
It's a strange thing you asked that. My father was a brilliant engineer, and back in the 1960s, he and a fellow engineer came up with what at the time was the best desalinization ever. They got a patent on it. The Boeing Aircraft Company bought the patent, put it in a safe, locked it up, and it was never seen again.
The Boeing Company? Why?
The Boeing. Great question. Why? Well, who knows? But what the thing is, my father's invention was based on 25 cents a gallon gasoline. And was totally impractical now in this high-energy world. But they had a method of turning seawater into fresh water at a higher rate, more efficient than anybody had ever seen, and big business bought it up and put it away. I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
Your dad didn't leave you the plans?
Nope. Everything is gone. It was just a sad deal.
How much did they buy it for? I'm curious.
We got a trip to Hawaii. He paid off some bills. He was a visionary man who actually had some great ideas. He actually had an idea to bypass Seattle to take all freight from Chicago straight to Alaska. And in the 1960s, the longshoremen were very powerful. And that was the mafia of Seattle. And I remember my father getting his threatening phone calls. And it was a scary time.
The unions, which I support. You know, of course, they were just as guilty as some of the companies years ago in creating some of the problems we have today. But, man, I still think people need them for protection from some of the things that are happening out there. But those were rough days, Peter, in this country.
Oh, they were. I think, again, I was just a boy in the 50s and early 60s. But, boy, it was a whole different type of power politics back then. And there was power politics. I mean, there was graft everywhere. Every city had it. You had a big city mayor, and you had a series of machines. And so my kids now, you know, they say, oh, Dad, you tell us these stories about back then. It couldn't be true. And, yeah, it was.
Yeah. Now, and I was a little confused. Did you say your father invented a way to get 25 cent gasoline or cheap water?
Oh, no, cheap water. But it was predicated on the fact that it needed 25 cent a gallon gasoline. It was highly energy intensive. So it was at a time when gasoline was 25 cents a gallon. And now,
I see.
Gasoline,
okay.
Yeah, so it's just a dinosaur who's now extinct.
And it would not make sense economically today then.
I'd love to see the plans, but I think that's not going to happen. So, no, I don't think so.
Okay, but you know, back to the question, though. Why aren't we desalinating? Why can't we do it? Is it that the Saudis are doing it, aren't they?
They are, but again, it's a very, very energy intensive. And the Saudis, look, they're sitting on the biggest reserve of oil in the world. To them, this is just free energy, essentially. So the water is way more valuable to them than the oil. We have still, for instance, in Seattle, Washington, I we have gigantic lakes. There's plenty of water in the Northwest.
Yes.
California is a whole different story.
That's a different story. There's a lot of water in the Midwest. I mean, St. Louis has got more water than it needs right now. So there are areas in this country that have a lot. There are other areas that don't have hardly any.
Well, you're talking about geoengineering and moving water on vast scales. And again, once we start thinking of these big projects, that really does seem like so last century, doesn't it? It's difficult to get any major work done anymore with the way the laws are set up.
Peter, are these droughts caused by massive earth changes, and are they, you know, repairable, or are they going to continue to get worse?
Well, they're certainly going to be variable, as you know. There's no straight line in climate change. Things get worse, things get better, things get worse. But you can definitely see the trend now that these droughts are increasing in ferocity. A lot of it is simply the fact that as the climate gets warmer, we are changing the pattern of air currents. I mean, I have to laugh a lot when people say we have a big snowstorm as we had in the East Coast a couple of years. They say, see, there's no global warming. We've got a snowstorm. What they don't recognize is there's more water in the atmosphere. That's where you get the snow from. Why is there more water in the atmosphere? Because the entire planet is a little bit warmer. More water is evaporated. That's pretty simple,
right.
but it doesn't get across.
I think, again, the sun is heating up. I'm not a believer. I think mankind has contributed. But I think we're in an earth cycle. I think this was going to happen anyway. And the fact that the sun is heating up, it's just speeding things along. What do you think of that?
Well, a lot of friends ask me, how can we change what you see as global warming? And I say, there's one really simple answer. Just put a lid on every volcano on the planet and the problem's over.
There you go.
Well, it's true. Think about all the CO2 that's coming out of the volcano. Yep. It utterly dwarfs what humans are doing.
And you don't have, that's right. You don't have populations of humans down there by the volcanoes feeding the fuel there. You're absolutely right. And what about in the oceans? What about the volcanoes underwater? Are they contributing to any of this?
Yep, they do. I mean, there's an awful lot of gas goes right into the water around them. It eventually can percolate out. But the Earth is still so hot on the inside, and we're going to have, for billions of years, diminishing but a continuing amount of carbon dioxide just coming out of the planet itself. We humans are also producing carbon dioxide, but it's a case where the Earth at least, look, if we didn't have the little bit of carbon dioxide, the entire planet would be frozen now. We only have 400 parts per million. Think about this. Have a million molecules, only 400 of them are carbon dioxide.
And
it's enough to keep us from freezing.
We had more carbon dioxide a million years ago, didn't we?
Yeah, well, during the Ice Age, it has gone up and gone down and gone up and gone down. So there's certainly been this cyclic, at least the Ice Ages themselves, it's been variable. But it's quite clear the trend and the direction now is straight line up, up, up. Now, the consequences, we're going to have to wait and see for a few decades, but it certainly looks like the consequences of ever more carbon dioxide or ever warmer temperature.
All right, Peter, stay with us. We're going to come back for a final hour to go with you, and we're going to take phone calls from all our listeners from all over the planet. Peter's in Australia, so you're going to hear about a second and a half lag time there. And I've got to time my questioning so I don't step on him. So we've been holding on pretty well, the two of us, doing all of that. His website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. All you have to do is go to those. And again, some of his books, The Medea Hypothesis, Is Life on Earth Ultimately Self-Destructive? That's probably a yes. Under a Green Sky and Rare Earth. All of those next with Peter Ward and your questions on Coast to Coast AM.